Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with her permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker. It's Diane from Huntington Beach.
Hi there, I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Diane.
And I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad to be inside. It is cold out there. I want to say happy birthday to Steve and to Marcia. I think that for me, it is amazing that people with the kind of difficulty that we have with alcoholism, the disease that makes you kill yourself, even as you're trying to live life to the fullest, you're killing yourself. And I, for one, could not stop. I got sober in Huntington Beach, still in Huntington Beach, 1973. April 4th. So, if I live until April 4th, I will be 40 years sober. And yeah, and I just want to say, yes, I was 12. No, I wasn't. But I have had such difficulty staying sober. In the beginning, the first 20 years were not easy for me. And if that scares you, do the work. Just do the work. And you don't have to do it the way I did it. But I had a lot of great ideas when I got sober. I mean, seriously, I knew things. And I had needs. And so it was quite difficult for me to stay here. God's grace for me and the help of you, the hope I got sitting in the meetings that maybe if you could do it, I could do it. But it wasn't easy. And I will tell you a little bit about where I came from. I would like to share mostly about my journey here because it has been the best part of my life. I started drinking when I was 14. And I started drinking very simply because I felt insecure, inadequate, and afraid almost all the time. And somebody offered me a bottle of peppermint schnapps. Okay? I'm telling you, it's like a warm candy cane. I mean, if you have never had peppermint schnapps, sorry, you can't have it now. But it was a lovely way to get started, I'll just be honest with you. They handed me a half pint, and they didn't get it back. It was wonderful, and I felt better immediately. I don't know if that's a trait of alcoholics, if it just takes care of it for us immediately, which is why we keep trying to get that feeling back, no matter what happens. But that peppermint schnapps was my answer. I didn't understand why we didn't get it at birth, because it changed the way I saw things. It changed what I was able to do. I wasn't afraid anymore. I had answers. I knew things. I got smarter, prettier, funnier. I mean, and then after a few, who cares? Doesn't matter. I just had a good time. And I immediately started getting in trouble. I don't know about you, but I immediately drank too much, and I wanted to do it again. I ended up in juvenile hall by the time I was 15, and in correctional school. They used to call it reform school, but they call it correctional school now, didn't correct a thing for me, but I'm sure it works for some people. And it was a 6-month program, and I stayed for 11 months, which is pretty much what you need to know about me. Don't tell me no. Please don't tell me I can't do it, because then I have to. I have to do it once. If it kills me, I have to. And don't tell me I have to do something. That is just, don't tell me I have to, because I can't. When I was a kid, my dad said to me one time, we were in the car and I was yelling about something, being really annoying. I was probably 10. And he said, one more peep and I'm going to hit you. I peeped. I had to. I didn't talk. I peeped. And he didn't hit me either. I think he laughed. But it was a part of my personality that was very difficult for me to get past. Because I just had it. You know that thing that just happens inside? No. No, I'm not doing it. And so I started drinking. I started hanging out with the people who drank. And I grew up in the 60s. I'll tell you right now, I just got old enough to get Medicare. So you know that I wasn't 14. I actually got sober when I was 25. And between the years I started drinking and being 25, a lot happened. I lied about how old I was to get alcohol. I slept with people I didn't know to get alcohol. I stole alcohol off the shelves and took it out of your refrigerator. Sorry if it was any of you. I didn't have any morals. I didn't understand what morals were until I got sober. I had no value. I did what I needed to do to get what I needed. And so I grew up in the 60s. And that was a time of things that chemically aided you in your alcoholism. I don't know another way to put it. I'm not going to tell you a lot about my history with drugs because I am an alcoholic. And if I don't drink, I don't do that other stuff either. But it was a part of my journey. And some of the interesting stuff was, you know, using acid before it was illegal and having, you know, all these great experiences and not being able to remember them. For me, I couldn't remember anything. I used to do reds and whites and two and alls and a little social heroin periodically and smoked anything you could smoke and never once without alcohol. I drank. Alcohol was the answer for me. The other stuff just helped me stay awake. I used to hang out with people. Somebody was asking me, because I live in Huntington Beach, if I was a surfer. Well, yes, I was. For a brief period of time, when I was drinking and living in Huntington Beach, I had this big red surfboard. I mean, not this big, but I mean, it was huge, and I carried it with me everywhere. Because I told you before, I was really insecure, and nothing about me felt like enough. So I made shit up. I mean, I just did. So I got this big red surfboard, and I carried it everywhere I went, and I waxed it, and I loved it. But I don't go in the ocean because I'm scared of sharks. I have been since I was a kid. But I loved the surfboard, and I loved the idea of having long hair and being a surfer. So I carried it, and after a while, people get suspicious when you don't go in the ocean. And I started feeling a little bit phony, so I gave up surfing. I know. I also was an American Indian for 10 years because I love the American Indians. How could you not love them? And because I'm Czechoslovakian. And it's really hard to say when you're drunk. And who cares if you're Czechoslovakian? So I got to know what people liked and what made people go, really? What kind? And that made me feel special. So I made stuff up. And I was an American Indian. Sometimes I was a Lakota, sometimes I was a Sioux. It just depended on what I could remember when you asked me. And the hardest thing I ever gave up was that. Because I lied for the first 6 months I was sober. And a friend of mine who actually is an American Indian asked me to go help our people. I know. What are you going to say? Norm, I'm not an Indian. And today, that is one of the biggest regrets. I also hung out with some motorcycles. They were talking about motorcycles earlier when I got here tonight. And I used to hang out with the Hessians and the Devil's Disciples. They were great guys, one-on-one. But when they were in a group, they were a little frightening. And so I would drink a lot and take a lot of whites at that time so that I could last through their whole party. Because if you didn't last through the whole party, they woke you up with lighter fluid and a match. Yeah, I know. And that just didn't seem entertaining to me. So I hung out with them, but I made sure that I was chemically balanced. And when I was probably 22 or 23, I started looking for him. You know, we all do it. Just look for the other half to make me feel like a whole person. And I found somebody who didn't ask a lot of questions. In fact, when we got divorced, I didn't know enough about him to get an annulment. That's how close we were. And he just asked me to marry him. I said yes. It was wonderful. I mean, seriously, I love weddings. I do. They're great fun, and you get to drink a lot, and people, you're the center of attention, people love you, you get to wear a pretty dress. I love weddings. Marriage, hard. Marriage is difficult, because you have to compromise and do stuff like laundry and cook. I still don't do that. Well, I do my laundry. Don't worry. Clean clothes. But I still don't like to cook too much. But I married this lovely guy, and I feel sad sometimes that I never knew where he ended up, so I could never make amends to him for not ever really being there in the marriage. I didn't know how. I just knew that I wasn't a whole person. I thought he could help. And it didn't help. And I spent a lot of time drinking and a lot of time not at home. And so when I was 24, I got arrested again. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, I actually came to AA when I was 18. But you were old then. When I was 18, I could have used Alcoholics Anonymous. But the people were like 30 and 50 and old. And the speaker one night when I went to a meeting was Chuck C. He was sober as long as I was old. And that was not enticing to me at the time. I thought, I'm 18. I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life miserable with nothing to drink. I can't. I'm 18. So I went back out for 7 years and came back when I was 25. And I will tell you that nothing good happened during those 7 years. Not one good thing. It was all difficult. I have a family, as most of you do, who is incredibly dysfunctional. Just incredibly. I have a sister who's paranoid and a brother who's narcissistic, and then I'm alcoholic. We were just all lovely for our parents, and I had a dad that I just loved. I mean, I just loved my dad. He was the one person in my family who I knew, in spite of my behavior, loved me. I knew that no matter what I did, he loved me, and I still stole from him and lied to him and hurt him very badly. One time he said, Diane, I just know I'm going to read the paper and you're going to be there with your throat cut, because that's how I lived and those are the people I hung with. And it made him cry. I loved my dad. And if I could have stopped for anybody, I would have stopped for him. I would have done it differently for him, but I couldn't. I was drunk in an hour. And if I could tell you why, I would. I don't know. Because I'm alcoholic. Because I'm alcoholic. And because I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest when I drink. I just can't. So I left my dad. I left my family. And they moved north. My mom moved to Michigan. And I moved to Huntington Beach. I don't know why. I wish I could tell you why I went to another meeting. I don't know why. I went to meetings when I was 18. Everybody was old. But when I was 25, something had changed. They were younger. Well, I was older. But there were some younger people there. And there were a lot of young people's meetings. And I looked around at the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, I don't really fit in here, but I'm tired. I don't know how you got to AA, but when I was 25, I was tired. I mean, I had done everything except for really hold a job. I just wasn't good at working. I was really good at stealing, which is why my ninth step was so intense. I had a lot of amends to make, but I was really poor at working. So I didn't really work until I got sober. And I came into a group in Huntington Beach, Friday night, downtowners. And the old timers in that group were the people who greeted at the door. The coffee maker at that time was 13 years sober. And everybody participated. So I kind of looked them over and I thought, you know, there's a couple of cute guys here. I think I'll stay for a while. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because of the cute guys. It doesn't matter why you come. It matters what you do. And I want to tell you that I have not done anything perfectly. There hasn't been any time in my recovery that I have done it perfectly, but I've continued to do it. I got sober in that group, and I asked this crazy Irish woman to be my sponsor, because she used to swear from the podium, and I really liked her. And her name was Annie. They called her Crazy Annie when I got sober. They called her Irish Annie later. And she was a great gift in my life. We were a lot alike. We both were liars and thieves and swore a lot. And I just identified with her and I wanted what she had. But then she wanted me to work the steps. I don't need to. It says grave emotional and mental disorders. Well, I'll tell you what I forgot to tell you is I've been in and out of Norwalk Mental Hospital. I knew I didn't have grave emotional and mental disorders. They released me. So I didn't think I had to do the steps. And I, you know, I didn't like people telling me what to do. So that was hard. And so I got rid of Annie as a sponsor for a while. I ended up taking her back later, but lucky for her. But I came in looking for God's will again. I mean, hell, I was sober now. Should be something there for me. So I looked at the meeting, the cute guys, and there was this guy who came into the meeting with just lots of hair and big brown eyes, and they called him Crazy John. I thought, my sponsor is Crazy Annie. Crazy John. So I went to meetings hanging out with Crazy John, and we had a lot in common. We were both 10 months sober, and we both played guitar. So I knew that we were meant to be together. I mean, I knew it. So we hung out with each other, and he explained to his wife and kids what had happened, and yeah, I know. We got married and lived happily ever after for 11 months. Yeah, and you know, I never learned any lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous easily. I don't know about you, but when I married somebody else's husband and hurt her and her children the way I did and was unable to drink that away, it changed the way I behaved. Those are the things that change my behavior. I don't know about you, but I've made a lot of mistakes here. And I have never gone out with another married man since then. I can't pay the price for that anymore. And I think that it's sad that that's the way I have to learn, but it seems to be the most effective for me. I make the mistake, and I choose the price I'm willing to pay. And I'm not willing to pay the price of feeling like that. The other thing that you should think about when you're electing group officers is don't make somebody who hasn't worked the step your treasurer. Don't do that. It's really foolish. My group did that. I was the treasurer of this very large group, collected a lot of money, borrowed it. I borrowed it. And by the time I told my sponsor, it had been a year, and she said, you know, looks so much like stealing to me that I think if you told the group you stole it and offered to pay them back, you'd probably stay sober. So I went to the group and I said, taking all your money, well, not all of it, but most of it, you're probably going to have trouble making the rent. So, what do you want to do? And they said, well, Joe stole money from the group, and Rita stole money from the group, and Fred stole money from the group, and Rita and Fred paid it back, and Joe didn't. He's not here anymore. So you choose, what do you want to do? I paid him back. Took me 2 years, and do you know what else I don't do anymore? I don't steal. If I go to a market and they give me 50 cents and I should only get 30, I give them 20 back. If somebody leaves something in a seat and I see them walk out, I chase them, I don't keep it. Everything about what I used to do for fun and free changed when I went through that experience with my group. Now, I don't recommend stealing your home group's money so that you can learn how not to steal. I mean, I really don't recommend it. But I am telling you that that's what worked for me. And it also made me understand why I always felt like a thief. Seriously, I didn't know why I would always, like somebody would be missing something and I would think they'd think I took it. Because I was a thief, because I stole stuff. That stealing makes you feel like a thief. And how long do you have to be sober to learn that? It took me a long time. I started sponsoring people when I was about 6 years sober. Now people sponsor people when they're 6 months sober. I didn't have anything anybody wanted until I was 6 years sober. I'm telling you, it was very difficult for me. And the other thing I did habitually, without even thinking about it, is lie. I would say three instead of two. I just couldn't help myself. I had such a difficult time. And after a few times that sober people, sober friends of mine said, I thought you told me seven. I thought you told me you were born in Michigan, not Hawaii. I mean, after they busted me a few times, I started figuring out the price I was paying for that. And you know why I lied? Because I wasn't enough. There wasn't anything about me I liked. Nothing. I stole somebody else's husband. I stole my home group's money. I lied to everybody. I couldn't be an American Indian anymore. I had nothing. And I didn't know how to work. So my sponsor said to me, you've got to get a job. We're all self-supporting here. Okay. I had gone to college. Never gone to the classes. Well, I went to a couple, but I would sit out in the parking lot and drink. And then I would not want to go to class because I would be drunk. One time I went to class, I left my car running in the parking lot. I came back, I thought it was a lawnmower. It was my car. So I had experience at college and it wasn't good. I had a lot of incompletes. So when I went looking for a job, I didn't have any experience and I had little education. I went to high school and some college. She said, sit down with a paper, circle the things you can do, and just go look. So I sat down with the paper and I circled, you know, three or four things I could do, and one of them looked really good to me. Drive a truck. Drive. Not really good, but I could drive. I had a license. So I went to apply for that job. And he said, well, if you can come out here, I'll show you the truck. And I got in, and it was a stick shift. I didn't know how to drive a stick shift. I'm a girl. So I got in the truck, and I said, I don't know how to drive a stick shift. And he said, well, you've got 10 minutes. If you can learn to drive it in 10 minutes, you can have the job. It was a pickup and delivery job for a typesetting company. So, and if any of you are younger than 40, you probably don't know what typesetting is, but it's the way they used to do newspapers and magazines. And so I went out and I ground the gears really badly, but I was so grateful for the little directions on the knob. I mean, seriously, if you just know when to push in the clutch, you can tell by those little directions how to put it into gear. And I learned how to drive, and I got that job. And it was $100 a week, 1973, driving that little pickup truck. And 3 months after I got that job, one of their typesetters quit. And he said, do you know how to type? Well, I took typing in school because there's no homework. So, yay, I know how to type. So I got a job as a typesetter. When I had been there for a while, somebody came over and asked if I wanted to work for their company. They were a publisher of auto racing magazines. And why not? So I set type there and eventually after about 8 years became managing editor of that magazine. And it was a great job. Loved that job. And the reason I got that job is because I didn't say no to driving the truck. I didn't say no to the thing that I didn't know if I could do. I just tried. And I got the job as managing editor, and I worked there for 28 years. I loved that job. I thought I would retire there. And I just want to tell you that God works in my life even when it's stuff I don't want. Even when it's difficult, I can see the path that I've been on, and it wasn't anything I would have thought of. So I get that job. I have it for 28 years. And publishing, most of you probably know, is not doing well. So the company I worked for was purchased by another company, and they eliminated three positions. One of them was mine. And I thought, I got to find another job. So I went looking for another job. There isn't really much in publishing, and that's what I know. So A month after I was out of work, a big Suburban totaled my car. So I have no car, I have no job, and I had just moved the week that I lost my job. So I'm in a new place, and I'm just going to meetings, and I get up every morning and I just say, God, put me where I'm going to be of service. Just put me where you can use me. And I got to tell you, this didn't happen for me overnight. I'm telling you, the first 20 years, it didn't occur to me to ask God. It occurred to me to let God share, but I didn't ask. I just figured, you know, I did. And that's why I was always like this all the time. When this all happened, I just said, God, put me where I can be useful. And I figured I would find a job. No answer to any resume. Not even an email saying, sorry, or nothing. Not even I got it. Just nothing. I just kept sending things out into the void, and I answered everything that I thought I could do. And a friend of mine in a meeting knew my dilemma with the car. She had some in-laws who had an old car in their garage that they tried to give to their grandkids, but they said it was an old person's car. So she gave it to me. And so I had a car, and I'm looking for a job. And I go to a meeting on Monday night, and a friend of mine who is the CEO of a company said, my receptionist is pregnant and leaving on maternity leave. Can you help me? You can look for a job while you work here. So I said, okay, I'll help. So because I don't know how it works for other people, but I have to tell you, I can't sit around and think about what I'm going to do or what's going on. I will kill myself. I need to be out doing something. Even if it isn't what I choose, I need to be doing something. I need to be productive. I need to push your shopping cart. I need to carry your bags. I need to do something. So he said, be my receptionist. Now, I know how to answer phones. I'm good at it. I like to talk. So I said, of course, I'll do it 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. From that job, he hired me as a full-time human resources person. I'm the employee administrator at this company. And I don't know anything about human resources, except for I didn't like them on my last job. It's like justice. It is a great job. I'm getting to know a whole new group of people. I am 65 years old. I'm 39 years sober. I need to be active. I need to be involved. I can't rest on my laurels. I don't have any. I don't know how it is for you, but I don't have any laurels. You know what keeps me going to meetings and being of service? I know who I am. I know the alcoholic who lives in me, who walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, not gone. She's not gone. I'm not cured. Contingent on my spiritual condition. A reprieve daily based on my spiritual condition. And you know what makes a fit spiritual condition for me? What I can do for you. And if it weren't like that, believe me, I wouldn't be here. I would be out there doing it for me. Doesn't work. It just doesn't work for me. So I stayed sober for a long time. I paid my home group back. I had a sponsor. I did the steps. And I worked my job, and I became really pretty honest. I mean, I can't afford not to be. And yet, there's always something. I mean, for me, there's always something new to learn. I used to be very angry. Not always right out front about it, But I was very angry. And I didn't understand quite how angry I was until I was involved in general service. A friend of mine said, if you really want to get to the heart of recovery, go be a GSR. Yeah, all right. I went to be a GSR. I didn't know what they were talking about. They were arguing about how many lines they had. They were arguing about who should talk first. They argued about all these things, and I didn't know what they were doing. And so I stayed GSR, and they elected me the district committee member. I liked that job because you got a little gavel in that group, and you got to tell them when to stop talking, and I loved that part. And then they had an assembly, and they elected the area officers. And I just said, God, just don't want to be secretary. I'll do anything else. Just don't want to be secretary. I was elected secretary on the first ballot. So I'm secretary for 2 years. And you know what that taught me? How to listen. Because I had to take notes. I had to take minutes. I had to pay attention. And I heard a lot of different things when I was listening. You guys have a lot of heart in general service. There is a lot of love for Alcoholics Anonymous in general service. What they want is for the hand of AA to always be there for your kids and their kids and their kids. And so it's important that it's not about me. And it's not about California. And it's not about New York. It's about Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And it took my experience there to understand what that meant. I was elected delegate of the area in 1982. And I went to New York. And there were a lot of people with a lot of time. I was 34 years old. I had 9 years sober. And I was afraid there. I went in and I thought, all these people know all these things. I don't know a lot. And so I felt like I was probably going to get impeached when I went home because I was a bad delegate. And I decided to quit and go home. And there was a guy who was the trustee at the time. His name was George D. He later became the general office manager for 10 years. But he was a great guy. And he said, you know, Diane, one of these days you're going to have to quit worrying about how you feel and just do the job you're asked to do. Because I promise you, in 5 years, they'll never remember you were a delegate anyway. And the truth was, half my friends didn't know what a delegate was when I was delegate. So as harsh as I thought he was, not understanding my feelings, I have to agree with him. You do the job you were given to do to the best of your ability, and then you move on. You just do what you need to do. If you take the job, do it. Do it as well as you can. And there's always another job. So general service taught me that Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of a lot of different groups, a lot of different people, a lot of different states. The needs we have here are not necessarily the needs they have in Nebraska. And sometimes other things are more important than the things I want. It made me look at Alcoholics Anonymous differently. What I know is, I want the hand of AA to be there for anybody who has a problem with alcohol, like I have a problem with alcohol. I don't have any judgment on what you believe in or where you're from or how long you're sober or how you do it. I want the hand of AA to always be there for you, and for that I am responsible. So I spent the last almost 20 years doing what most people do in their first 20. I've gone to a lot of meetings. I have pretty much dedicated my life to being of service to God and my fellows, because it's the only way that I'm happy. I heard somebody say earlier that what we want for you is to be happy. I don't know about you, but I didn't have a freaking clue what happy was. I thought happy was being famous and rich and having 25 cars and a lot of friends and being adored. I had no idea that happy was being useful. Watching the light come on in someone's eyes that you sponsor, and you know that they were absolutely hopeless when they got here and they had absolutely no future. And to watch things, like I sponsored a woman in 1980. All she ever wanted was to have kids. She couldn't have kids. So she was a year sober and adopted a boy. He's 32. And I watch people send their kids to school. I watch people get their kids back. I watch people get jobs and have careers and become useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's something magic about recovery. I wish I could tell you what it was. Although if I could, I'd probably try to sell it. So it's really better that I don't know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the life it's given me. I am excited every morning when I wake up to see what happens in my day, because I have no idea. I have no idea. Life is exciting for me. And I know in the book it says upon awakening, but I'm 65. And I don't know about you, but I wake up at 2, 3, 5. So upon which awakening? I have something that works for me. I get up every morning and take a shower. Every morning I take a shower. That's where I make connection with God. Every morning in the shower, I say the third step prayer. And I thank Him for everything He's given me and everything He's taken away. And especially for everything He's left me with. I am someone who should not be alive. That was who I was when I got here, and that is who I am without you. I spent 4 years very depressed here and very suicidal, and the only reason I'm still here is because of you. Because you gave me hope. My hope is with you, it's not with me. As long as I am participating in my recovery, as long as I'm going to meetings, as long as I'm holding out my hand to somebody else, what do you need? Then my life is amazing. It's nothing I would have chosen. And it's everything that fills that deep hole in me and makes me happy to be alive. So give yourself a break. Just do the work they ask you to do. Don't be like that little mouse with the big eagle. There's this cartoon. I know Stan's joke was really bad. This one, I'm in a church, so I really can't do it. But you know, you all have that middle digit. And it's the ultimate act of defiance with this little mouse giving the middle digit to the big eagle. That's how I was when I got here. And now it's just like, let's just do it together. Let's just fly together. I don't have any defiance. You want me to do something, I'll try it. You want to know how I got sober 39 years? I didn't drink. Because I went to meetings, I read the book, I did the steps, I hung out with you. And I let you love me when I couldn't. And you gave me the ability to love people who can't love themselves. There isn't a greater gift I've been given in my life than to be sober with you. Thank you so much.